Good morning. With an ongoing teacher shortage in Hawaii, you'd think the DOE would want every licensed teacher it could find. Today, we'll find out from the Hawaii Teacher Standards Board exactly what licensed means. Foster families will now get more to care for the kids in their care. We'll talk about the settlement to a lawsuit that brought the change. And as part of our participation in the NPR project, A Nation Engaged, Neil Conan looks at America's place in the world. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Young voices from throughout the Pacific are telling their stories through a range of media to kick off the 2016 IUCN World Conservation Congress Forum. And a Maui nonprofit focuses on education to help one of South America's poorest nations.
That's the conversation. Now the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
This question has come up before. What exactly does it take to teach in Hawaii schools?
Well, we thought we'd get some clarity about that this morning. Now, at the beginning of every school year, we frequently hear about Hawaii's teacher shortage. That happened again this year, too. And we also heard from a former Florida teacher with a master's degree certified to teach six subjects with an out-of-state license valid until 2019. Now, she wasn't hired, and she's moved on to a job with another state agency. But we thought that we would really get some clarification about this issue of licensure. We called Lynn Hammonds of the Hawaii Teacher Standards Board. She joins us now in our studio. Good morning. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, good morning, Beth Ann. My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So let's talk a little bit about what it means to be licensed in Hawaii. When you come out of school, that's one thing. You go through the testing that's required and you become a teacher. And when you come from elsewhere and you're already a teacher and you bring in your license from someplace else, what has to happen then?
Okay, Beth Ann, well, there are multiple options for becoming a licensed teacher in Hawaii. There are actually three different types of licenses. The first license is a provisional license, and that could be awarded to someone either who has completed preparation in Hawaii or in another state in a state-approved teacher preparation program. There's also a standard license, and that's probably really what you're asking about here. The standard license could be awarded to someone who has a license in another state if that person was first licensed in that state on July 1st, 2006 or after. Hawaii has full reciprocity, meaning when they apply for their Hawaii license, our office would validate or verify their license in the other state. They would have to provide verification of 3 years of teaching experience out of the last 5 years, and then they'd be awarded a Hawaii license. If they were first licensed in another state prior to that July 1st, 2006, we would also verify that they met basic skills and content knowledge competency. And there are multiple ways to do that. So someone coming from another state with an active license in that state could certainly be licensed pretty quickly and pretty easily as long as we're able to verify that information.
What does pretty quickly and easily look like? Are we talking about a matter of months or a six-month period? Or, you know, if they met all of the qualifications that you just outlined and you verify it, what are they talking about in terms of being able to teach?
Well, Beth Ann, the Teacher Standards Board has an online electronic licensing system. So if someone applied for a license this morning and under those circumstances we talked about where they have the current license in the other state, if that state has an online verification system and we were able to verify it today, that person could be licensed by the end of today, maybe even sooner.
That's fast.
It is. Of course, sometimes when we're trying to verify something from another state, if they don't have an online verification system in that state, it could take longer. And sometimes, everything's dependent upon getting verification from the other state.
Now, there may be people out there who have a teacher's license from someplace else, but they've heard all kinds of stories or they're concerned about whether or not they're going to be able to teach here. You've put some of that to rest, but in terms of what we talk about from the DOE side when that's, you know, they're rated as being qualified or highly qualified, that's not something you have any control over.
That's correct. The highly qualified status is set by the Department of Education, and our standards board is an independent board. So that the board was actually formed so that teachers could have control over setting the standards because they are the experts in education. So it's an independent agency separate from the Department of Education.
So should the driver then be from the standards board back to the DOE as opposed to the other way around?
Well, we're really talking about two different things, licensure and employment. So certainly for anyone seeking a license first, they should contact our office. If they're looking for employment, they would certainly want to talk to the department or a charter school or a private school.
Should there be an easier path to accreditation in any other way for a teacher who is coming here and maybe doesn't have an active license but was teaching in the past?
Well, there is an option for that person. If they completed a teacher preparation program in another state and they can verify basic skills or and content knowledge, then they would be eligible for a license. So here in Hawaii. So even if they don't have an active teaching license in another state, there are still ways for them to obtain a Hawaii license.
And is that something that's a long and lengthy procedure?
If they've already completed the program, then it's simply a matter of getting verification from that program, wherever it's located. If a person hasn't completed a teacher preparation program, there are Hawaii programs, there are programs in other states, there are online programs. So I would say probably the least amount of time that someone would spend in a teacher education program would be 1 year, and they could certainly spend up to 3 or 4 years if it was an undergraduate program.
For teachers who are for, you know, people who were teaching at some point in time and they were obviously accredited and licensed and then they went away from teaching. We've heard from, you know, teachers both in Hawaii and people who've come to Hawaii who've said, you know, I was teaching for a while. I've decided that's not for me in the current circumstance. And then a little while later, they begin to miss it and they want to come back. What's the path back?
Okay. So we talked about with the standard license that a person would need 3 out of the last 5 years of active teaching experience. So if someone's been out of teaching for more than 5 years, they could still apply for a provisional license. They would need to provide evidence of that preparation program, basic skills and content knowledge verification, and then they could be a fully licensed teacher.
With the fact that we're constantly told that we have a teacher shortage, is there something that you see from your end that you'd like to see happen within Hawaii, either from the DOE or just in general, that might stem that tide better than we've been able to do in past? Because very clearly we're still down. If you talk to the DOE, I mean, well over 450 teachers still needed.
Right. In the 15-16 school year, the Standards Board convened a work group on alternative routes to licensure. And one of the things that we particularly focused on was the licensing of current educational assistants in Hawaii schools, or EAs. So we actually interviewed EAs, and we also brought in members of the teachers union, the department, teacher preparation programs. And what we learned from those folks, because basically they're already in our schools, they would be homegrown teachers, we found that they were most concerned about the cost of school tuition because most of those individuals need to finish their bachelor's degree. They were concerned about the time and travel to and from the preparation programs. So we think that preparation programs that meet them where they are in their schools, in their districts, and also tuition assistance for them to finish their bachelor's degree and their preparation program would certainly help increase the ranks of licensed teachers in Hawaii.
We've got to go in just a second, but how likely is that to happen?
Well, we think it's very likely to happen. Some preparation programs already provide assistance to these folks in terms of validating experience that they've had in the classroom And, of course, we're always open to tuition credit for people who are wishing to be teachers.
I wish we had more time. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lynn Hammonds is the Executive Director of the Hawaii Teacher Standards Board. Among other duties, she assists in the development of activities, policies, and procedures for the organization and implementation of the board's policies. Now, school is only one part of the equation for a stable life for a child. And for foster kids, stability is often in short supply. In part, according to some foster parents, it's because of the cost to care for the kids. That changed with the settlement to a lawsuit we talked about a few years ago. Gavin Thornton of the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice joins us now with what that settlement could mean for current and future foster parents. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me, Beth Ann.
So the big issue that we talked about 3 years ago when this lawsuit was filed was the fact that for a lot of parents who are caring for foster kids, there is a substantial cost. I mean, any parent knows how much it costs to be able to raise a child, and there's so many hidden costs and things that just, you know, come up. But the amount of money that was being provided for each child was simply, according to a lot of the parents who talked to us, just not enough. What became enough?
That's actually hard to say, and that was one of the big issues in the case. So foster parenting is a volunteer effort. These folks are opening up their homes and their hearts and taking in these children that they've never even met before, and trying to provide the same type of future that they would provide for their own kids. And I think any parent knows that it costs a lot to raise a child. When the case was filed, the reimbursement rate, it's called, was $529 a month. It hadn't been increased for over 23 years. And inflation during the meantime had gone way up. So we were hearing from a lot of folks that just said that it was getting too costly to continue to foster parent, that they were having to make significant financial sacrifices to do it that they just couldn't afford.
So now with the amount that they will get after the case, you're talking about, you know, $676 for kids who are 12 and up. That doesn't sound like a huge difference from the $529.
Well, actually, that $676, so right before the case was filed, the folks at Department of Human Services were looking into an increase and did request an increase that was implemented about 6 months after the case was filed. The $676 figure that you just mentioned was part of that increase. Now what we're looking at is $649 for ages 0 to 5, $742 for ages 6 to 11, $776 for ages 12 and up. That's a pretty significant bump.
So the point being that over the last 3 years that foster parents have seen an increase both from what DHS thought would be an adjusted amount to what they actually might be getting now.
That's right. And we think that is going to provide significant relief for foster parents. We're so excited about this development and so appreciative of everyone coming together, really the Department of Human Services. Rachel Wong was a very important part of getting this resolved. The folks at the Attorney General's office, everybody recognizing how important it is to do this for the kids in their care.
We got to go in just a second, but one of the things that we heard from foster parents over several years now, not just 3 years ago with this case, is that it's very tough to find families and that this was one of the barriers. If this is now a better scenario, do you expect that we will find more foster parents able to take children?
Yes. We're really hoping that folks that felt they had to leave because they could no longer afford it will come back, and that new families will come into the system that can provide a good, solid home for these kids.
And there were about 6,000 kids in the system?
That's right.
So a lot of families needed for those.
That's right.
of that, do you have any idea how many kids are already with families, or is that just the total number of kids that we have in the system and it's hard to tell?
So that 6,000 figure includes children that were placed into the foster care system and then ultimately adopted by their foster parents. We don't really have a good sense of where everybody's at. We've had heard some anecdotes about, you know, children having to stay in shelters while DHS workers are searching for foster parents, but we don't have figures on that.
Well, that sounds like there is a study that's very ripe and overdue. Gavin Thornton, thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thanks again for having me.
We'll be watching this. Gavin Thornton is the co-executive director of the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. He was part of the group of advocates that had been seeking an increase in the funding available to care for kids in the foster care system. The settlement of the lawsuit over the cost of care was announced this week. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:19 in about 6 seconds, 8:20. Coming up, young voices concerned for the ocean. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Today's beach backyard can be seen from Hawaii's forbidden island of Niihau. This coastal land area used to operate as a sugarcane business in the early 1920s. Later, it became a runway for private planes. Just prior to World War II, the U.S. Army acquired this land, renamed the airfield Mana Airport, and paved the runway. As World War II progressed, the airfield grew to encompass nearly 2,400 acres. In 1964, the U.S. Army transferred this backyard to the U.S. Navy. Present-day shortwave broadcasts from this backyard include time signals from an atomic clock and weather alerts for portions of the Pacific Ocean. In the vicinity of this facility is the town of Kekaha. Several generations of Kekaha's Kama'aina families worked for the sugar mill prior to its closing in the year 2000. For today's backyard quiz, what coastal military use area are we in, and what type of high-tech testing occurs here? We'll have the answer in the second half of our show. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the first one to get it right will get a T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Chris Okuhara from Miso and Ale. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
When children grow up in poverty with no access to a decent education, it's all too likely they'll remain poor throughout their lives. Somos Ohana Nicaragua is a group of people on Maui who know all too well how poverty robs children of a future. They focus their efforts on building schools in one of the poorest parts of South America, northwestern Nicaragua. Charlotte Flavin is the executive director of Somos Ohana Nicaragua, and she's on the line with us now. Good morning, Charlotte.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. Thanks for talking with us. How long has this effort been underway?
For 17 years.
How did it get started?
Well, we started as a response. My husband and I, Daniel Flavin, and I had the opportunity to help when Hurricane Mitch that happened in 1998, mm-hmm. and there was recovery efforts continuing through 1999. So we went in 1999 to help with the recovery efforts in that area of Nicaragua. We had planned only to go for a month, which is our vacation time, but then when we left, when we were leaving, the people said, "Oh, we have this need and that need," and they started enumerating a whole lot of stuff. So we've been going back ever since.
What were when they first told you what their needs were? What were the primary needs that you heard about?
The primary need was in both in health, especially services for children with special needs, mm-hmm. and also for education. Children were not going to school for a bunch of reasons, and some of those schools were falling apart. They had been constructed a long time ago. There was a big effort at that time of the European Union to help build schools, and they did in areas that didn't have some schools, but there were still, those were the grade schools mostly.
Yeah.
So anyway, the education and health were two areas that were very noticeable.
What was it about the economy in this area of Nicaragua that made it so poor? Was it just poor land for agriculture, lack of infrastructure? What's the problem there?
Well, right after the hurricane just removed a whole lot of topsoil. For uh-huh. one thing, people who had houses, who had farms, lost most of the area. So it took actually until about now to recover. The only other problem is that now, at that time, they had too much rain. Mm-hmm. And there was a year shortly after that there was too little rain. These farmers depend on the rain.
Sure.
They know that they can have a crop. For historically, they could have a crop. The rains would come in May, and they would have a crop by July, August. That was what they call the primera, the first crop. The second crop would be from August to November.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the whole and that continued, that system continued fairly well until recently. So these, and now the last 3 years has been drought. So that's affecting this area again. However, I think the biggest thing is you have to realize that historically, a lot of the land that we're working in belonged to big haciendas,
mm-hmm.
owners that had a lot of property, and everybody worked for them
mm-hmm.
at very poor wages, and schools were not, there was no, about 15% of the population was literate, very literate. And then the rest of the people may have had some basic, very, very, very basic education, like learning how to sign your name,
mm-hmm.
Or even that. There was not any attention that this was the time of Somoza,
yeah.
you know, up until 79, when the revolution happened. And then there was a big thrust. But money-wise, that wasn't, the country didn't have that much money
mm-hmm.
to put into a lot of things. And they had, so between 80 and 90, there was a big thrust for education, especially grade school. Their hope was to get all their population to be literate, at least to the fourth grade level. That was their goal.
And, of course, prior to then, Somoza had little interest in educating
the
peasantry because he was very much a handmaiden of the large landowners, right?
Yes.
So that's at least an encouraging change. And is there a mindset now in the country that education is kind of the way out of this kind of rural poverty?
Right. And also that the people would like to stay on their areas, their rural farms, but they also want contact and a better a better way of life, too.
Sure.
You know, they want to be part of the system of having a voice in their lives, in their government, so, and taking care of the needs of the general population, which is greater, you know, in health care also. You know, if you, in the days before the revolution, if you were lucky enough to have somebody who was generous as your patron, they called him the patron, the owner of the hacienda, then if your baby got sick, he would send his doctor, or you would go to his doctor to take care of the baby.
Of course, that's very much an autocratic plantation economy, isn't it?
Right.
Charlotte, I'm afraid we have to go, but I wish you continued luck in your efforts, Jeff. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you. I hope people can come to Cafe Mambo to help us.
We'll see if we can send them your way. Charlotte Flavin is the executive director of Somos Ohana Nicaragua, which is holding a gathering Thursday, September 8th at Cafe Mambo in Paia from 3 o'clock to 9 p.m. Their organization is a nonprofit that is building the third wing of its newest secondary school in rural northwestern Nicaragua. You can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
There are more than 4,000 sustaining members of Hawaii Public Radio. We'd like to send a big mahalo to these supporters whose monthly contributions provide the station with a source of reliable income. Janice Okubo of Honolulu, Elizabeth Fackler of Waipahu, and Glenn Miyahara of Mililani. If you'd like to help HBR steer a stable course into the future, become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can give us a call and find out more at 955-8821. And thanks. A Hawaii special education aide says he saw abuse of a student, and later he was the one who got fired. But the DOE says it can't talk about the specifics of the case. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So with one person saying what he says he saw and the DOE remaining fairly silent on this, how do we know much about this case at all?
Well, we don't know for sure. We cannot confirm the details. But according to Aaron Hess, that's the name of the paraprofessional who was working briefly at Kaimuki Middle School, and what he said he saw was a special ed student, particularly he's a student with described as a nonverbal student, saw a teacher or an aide pour iced coffee over the head of the student. The student froze and cried, and Aaron Hess was quite disturbed by the whole thing, as you can imagine, and reported it to his employer and started asking questions. But it is only from him that we have heard this story. Others have flat out denied it. And as John Hill, our reporter, says in the story, the Department of Education has pretty much been silent, really not talking much at all about what happened or what didn't happen.
So when you say that he reported this to his employer, that's
correct,
a third party which is contracted to be an aide in school?
That's right, exactly. But not long after his complaint, the department, he was suspended from his work at Kaimuki Middle School. And then later, he was not allowed to work in the DOE at all. And this was coming at the behest of the Department of Education, which said that Mr. Hess was under investigation. So he is prohibited. They said he violated contract provisions by using his video phone, or the video capability on his smartphone to record what and document what he describes as abuse, he alleges. And they also said he was in error in the way he filed his complaint. So these are the reasons why they have removed him from the DOE.
That seems to be a procedural issue, or several of them. But in terms of trying to get a video of this, did he actually get a video of what he alleges is abuse?
Yeah, there is material that he did share with John Hill, our reporter. I should tell you what the DOE is saying. They do confirm there was an investigation of Aaron Hess, but that it's closed. It's a personnel matter, and it involves student privacy. They really couldn't talk anymore. They spoke generally about how they handle these sorts of things. But as we learn, it's really in contrast to how the trend nationally is when it comes to these kind of allegations at schools. The trend is for more public access, for the public to know exactly what's going on. Even if the cases are disproved, we have a right as the citizens to know how things are handled in our schools.
So what happened to that piece of video that he says that he took? Because usually when people do things like this, they tend to get out there and migrate. It seems in this case it really hasn't.
Yeah, he posted some stuff on his Facebook. And by the way, speaking of video, there is a video with Aaron Hess in John's story, which is up on our website today. So you can watch it and read the story and decide for yourself. But one wonders whether we're going to find out exactly what happened.
And anything coming from the child's parents?
No, you know, Aaron Hess says he didn't even know, try to find out whether the parents had even been contacted, and was shut down in that regard as well.
All right. Well, a case with a mystery. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bethann.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us every day with a reality check.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Monkey Pod Kitchen by Merriman, celebrating the craft of food, drink, and merrymaking with restaurant locations in Ko'olina, Oahu, and Wailea, Maui.
As you may have heard on the national news shows, NPR launched a series this week called A Nation Engaged. It starts with this query: what is America's place in the world? It's a question the next president will have to face, and its answer will be reflected in the U.S. role in global affairs, from fighting terrorism to trading with Asia. HPR is also participating in this project later this week on Town Square. And this morning, we begin with news analyst Neil Conan, who joins us most Tuesdays from his Macnut Farm on the Big Island. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Bracing for a little rain tomorrow, but everything else is good.
Okay, good. Aren't we all? There are so many directions that we could go with this topic. Let's try to narrow it down just a little bit and focus on the U.S. role in the Pacific. No one is ignoring places like, you know, China and Japan. Somehow the conversations, though, about the U.S. role in the world always seems to start in Europe and then go on to the Middle East. Why?
Yeah, it's so 20th century. To some degree, yes, obviously things in the Middle East are compelling. We fought two wars in Europe during the 20th century. But to some degree, it's because we're all brainwashed by Gregoris Mercator, the cartographer who first figured out how to make a flat map of the world. And he, of course, was European, a Dane, I think. And he put, of course, the Atlantic Ocean in the middle, the Europe on one side and the United States on the other side. And inevitably, it leaves Hawaii hanging off the edge of the world in the middle of nowhere. In the 21st century, we've begun to realize that Hawaii is, in fact, in the middle of the most dynamic region in the world that includes the world's three biggest economies. It is militarily challenging, and that's why we also hear about the pivot to Asia-Pacific that Barack Obama inaugurated, and that within a few years' time, 60%, for example, of the United States Navy is going to be based in the Pacific.
That's obviously, as you mentioned, all part of the military aspect. But the U.S. has the biggest economy in the world that you also mentioned. China's 2, Japan is 3. To hear it talked about in some circles, you know, it would seem that, you know, business and trade are the biggest parts of the U.S. role in the Pacific. Is that true?
You know, they go hand in hand. You know, the Pacific has been an American lake since 1945. Under the watchful eye of the Seventh Fleet, there has been 70 years of peace. I'm not skipping over the wars in Korea and Vietnam, which obviously did not turn out the way the United States would have liked. But even those wars did not challenge U.S. dominance in the Pacific. There has been no hint of interstate wars in the Pacific, and the peace engendered incredible prosperity. Japan rose from its ashes. South Korea and Taiwan overcame dictatorships to become vibrant democracies and modern economies. Australia and New Zealand are sort of in a class by themselves. Another economic miracle in Singapore.
And what about China?
I don't think any country profited more from U.S. hegemony than China. American power meant that it faced no external threat from the Soviet Union when it was weak and afflicted by Chairman Mao. American prosperity provided a market when China made the shift to export-driven capitalism, like Japan and Taiwan and South Korea had done before it. China has, its accomplishment is incredible. It's lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty in the past 30, 40 years. Yes, hundreds of millions yet to go, but China's transformation is in no small part a byproduct of American power.
That transformation that you just mentioned includes a modern military that seems able and sometimes even eager to challenge the U.S. In the Western Pacific, as we've seen in the not-too-recent past.
As we've seen. You know, this is what historians call the Thucydides trap. If you remember, the great Greek historian writing about the Peloponnesian War said that the status quo power cannot abide the rise of a new power. In his case, Athens was the maritime empire rising to threaten Sparta. The Peloponnesian War resulted. Athens was destroyed. Historians quibble that it's happened about 10 times since then, and it's resulted in war 7 times. The principal role of the United States in the Pacific is to manage its relationship with China, to make sure they don't fall into the Thucydides trap, to accept China as a great power, acknowledge its enormous accomplishments and its enormous pride in those accomplishments, without at the same time letting China bully its neighbors in the South China Sea.
That's not going to be easy, though. I mean, the South China Sea is one of the three flashpoints that I'd actually like you to talk about, something the next president is going to have to deal with. Earlier this summer, we talked about the International Court in The Hague rejecting China's claims in the area. Since then, it seems we've sort of been, waiting for the next shoe to drop.
Yeah, China rejects the ruling. It did not participate in the hearing. But it has not, since that ruling, taken military steps to reinforce its claims, which a lot of people expected. Some worry that it's just been waiting for the G20 summit that comes up next week and didn't want to create a crisis until it's over. It's, of course, hosting that summit. But so far, China's reaction has been restrained. The U.S. says it will continue the freedom of navigation patrols the Chinese consider provocative, but maybe not this week. That's not this right minute. But while the South China Sea is a powder keg, remember, $5 trillion worth of shipping cross the South China Sea every year. I want to repeat that. $5 trillion. There's trillions more in oil and gas believed to be beneath the seabed. That's not proven yet, but we'll find out. So nobody wants a war.
Okay, let's move to the next flashpoint. The uninhabited islands in the East China Sea, administered by Japan, also claimed, though, by China.
The Senkakus to the Japan, the Diaoyu to China. The fact that nobody lives there eases this a little bit. There's not quite the element of national pride there is for China in the South China Sea, but there is historical grievance. These islands have become the, sort of pressure point for China's deep anger with Japan over the invasion and the atrocities of the Second World War. Now, China can ratchet up tension with Japan there whenever it's angry about something else. The U.S., of course, becomes involved because of the mutual defense treaty with Japan. It's a flashpoint, but I don't think it's as dangerous or as complicated as the South China Sea.
Okay, so let's move on to the conundrum of North Korea. It's already a threat to South Korea. Its missiles can reach Japan and Guam now, and experts say it might be able to target Hawaii or the U.S. mainland with nuclear-tipped missiles, quite possibly before the end of the next president's term in office.
And this is not going to be easy no matter what. The only way to approach Pyongyang is through Beijing. China is the only country that holds levers on North Korea's behavior. It's been reluctant to use them so far, but Kim Jong-un is not popular in Beijing. He's not been granted a meeting with Xi Jinping, for example. The real fear is that young Kim does not see nuclear weapons as bargaining chips to win concessions. He sees them as crucial war-fighting weapons in a plan to reunify Korea on his terms. He would use them to nuke South Korean ports to stop U.S. reinforcements, to threaten U.S. cities on the West Coast, and hope the U.S. will not want to escalate. In effect, he would say, You want to save Seoul, I'll obliterate Seattle. Mm-hmm. Now, this is hugely dangerous, of course, and China will have to be persuaded to abandon one of its very few real allies.
Neil, we're running out of time, but I just want to ask you about what you said a second ago. Reunite Korea on his terms. South Korea is much richer and better armed than the North. That doesn't even count the U.S.
But they don't have nuclear weapons. Look, this whole scenario is crazy. But one prominent theory right now holds that the only way Kim sees to perpetuate North Korean state, to perpetuate his family's power, is to conquer the South, to remove it as an existential threat to his legitimacy. If that's what he's thinking, and I know nobody really knows, of course, but if that's what he's thinking, the U.S. role is to persuade Xi Jinping that there need to be fundamental changes in North Korea, that the alternatives are worse. Right now, though, this is not going well.
All right. For the moment, we're going to have to leave it there. We'll talk to you again next week.
Okay, Beth Ann.
Thanks, Neil. Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes here on Hawaii Public Radio. We'll continue the conversation on America's role in the world in a special edition of Town Square on Thursday, and segments on A Nation Engaged also continue all this week on All Things Considered and Morning Edition.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Have you ever gone to an orchestra concert and wondered how the orchestra came into existence? In Honolulu, it began as the Symphony Club. Its 14 players started performing in 1881. The concerts were often benefits to raise funds, not for themselves, but for charities. When it disbanded in 1895, a new group sprung up, calling itself the Amateur Orchestra. It had 24 players. The Honolulu Symphony Society was organized in 1902 by a group of German immigrants. This is the ensemble that ultimately became the Honolulu Symphony. During the orchestra's infancy, the players were primarily amateurs. They rehearsed in an old shed on Punch Bowl. Within a few years, it attracted many professionals who gave impromptu benefit performances, again for charity, raising the funds the old-fashioned way. They passed the hat around the audience. The orchestra we have today is yet another in our orchestral lineage, the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
And now we're getting back to our backyard quiz answer for today. We described a coastal backyard within view of Niihau. Its storied past includes history as a sugar mill and airfield, its World War II military usage by the Army and later by the Navy. The backyard has a neighboring community called Ke Kaha, and for today's quiz, we asked you what coastal military backyard we were in and what high-tech testing occurs here. And in fact, it was known as Pacific Missile Range Facility at Barking Sands on northwestern Kauai and is the largest complex of its type in the world.
And Beth Ann, our backyard quiz winner, is Ken Walper of Kailua. He knew the answer. He'll be getting a T-shirt. And that's today's quiz at 8:50. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
The 2016 IUCN World Conservation Congress Forum, which begins Thursday, is about the future. So it's fitting that young people should make their voices heard as that gathering gets off the ground. That's the thinking behind the Hawaii Conservation Alliance's event, He Pukoa Kani Aina, Bicultural Conservation Stories from Pacific Island Youth. Their stories are told in spoken word, slam poetry and song, and Lila Nouri, former director of the Hawaii Conservation Alliance, is on hand to tell us more. Good morning, Lila.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
What brought this idea about?
Well, we were thinking a few years ago, wow, we've brought this amazing Congress here. We've helped with hundreds of people to get into Hawaii. It was quite a chore with people like Chipper Wickman leading the show. And we thought, when all of the world comes here, what will we welcome them with? How will we start this off? How will we make sure we represent Hawaii properly, and especially to our emerging professionals? We run a huge next gen program, and we really wanted to make sure folks coming from other places could come and join us and actually get excited about it and understand how to work their way around such an event.
To what kind of professionals did you say? Imaging?
Emerging professionals.
Oh, emerging
professionals. The younger folks who might be first-timers at this Congress, our youth here in Hawaii who are budding professionals and wanted to basically come learn with their peers. You know, what are those, I guess, hot topics or cutting-edge, cross-cutting themes that are going to be addressed here? And so we think biocultural conservation will be something of necessary importance, and people will be talking about indigenous rights and conservation and how do we blend that with people and their needs. And so that's where we were headed, is we needed a creative space to do that and not just be in the hustle bustle of the Congress proceedings. So we wanted to do this earlier.
Sure. Yeah. And it looks as if you're also presenting in a non-traditional kind of way as well.
Exactly. As you know, we host the Hawaii Conservation Conference every year, and that's typical scientific presentations with panels and PowerPoints. But we felt like these messages might be better understood if they were, you know, displayed more creatively through artistic performance style talks.
Yeah. Well, the subject of a conference like the one coming up is really the future, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's why we want to focus on our future leaders as well, as we are faced with enormous challenges. And how will we go forward without looking back at our past and also being creative about the solutions we come up with for the future?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us don't really have that much stake in what's going to be happening 50 years from now, because we're not that likely to be around, right? But these guys are.
Absolutely.
That's a big part of it, I would think.
Absolutely.
What kind of individual presentations have you got?
Tonight, actually at 4 o'clock, is the start of the event. And really, we do have, three Pacific Islander youth coming to speak about their experiences as being islanders and climate change affecting their home islands, how they've adapted to that, how they're feeling about that. And then we also have in Hawaii a few folks. You might know Kalani Kiocho. You might have heard of Lea Kekueva, our youngest speaker, who are speaking about, again, their place in the world that is changing, and very much so as you're speaking about the future and what needs to happen there. It is that we need to look at it with, for example, a different pair of eyes. So I think that's a common thread, actually, throughout all of them, that they want to see change.
Sure.
They want to see something different, and they want to be a part of it. But they're also charged up and heavily, like, with all the capacity they need to actually meet those demands. And that's the exciting part, is you could see that optimism there and you feel it and you're moved by it, whether it's tears, whether it's anger, whether it's laughter. We have a whole spectrum of emotion coming out.
I would think that optimism, Lila, would be especially important, because it's all too easy to take a pretty doom and gloom approach to conservation issues, you know, and global warming and coral bleaching, and there are a lot of trends that aren't going in a particularly happy direction, aren't there?
It really is on the science level that way. But what I found is the hope and optimism comes in people and how we are working together and partnering to figure out how to feel like we can address these issues together. And that's really, I think, where all of conservation is going. And it's gone that way for so many years, where, you know, people are part of that solution. And it's really not about just the science behind it.
You know, one of the things I think that leads to a certain degree of optimism about conservation issues in the Hawaiian Islands is that if you sort of deal island by island, or ahupuaha by ahupuaha, you can reduce things to a manageable level, so it doesn't completely make you crazy how huge the problem is. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's absolutely true with a project we're also going to be highlighting at the Congress called the Watershed Snapshot, where we've been working with three communities to show that exact thing through creating communication materials that show what would be GIS information, geospatial information most people couldn't understand. We're helping them create communication tools that actually bring those issues up and show them what's in their watershed from the top of the Mauka to the bottom to the Makai. We found that working in smaller areas by community or by apua'a has really worked. And I think that's where the hope lies, because then people can see their impact.
You might not be able to clean up the ocean, but you can at least clean up your bay or something like that, right?
As a local individual, but we do hope we can clean up the ocean too, Chris.
You won't get an argument out of me, Lyle. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
Great to meet you. Lyle Lenore is the former director of the Hawaii Conservation Alliance and Foundation, which is presenting Heipukoa Kani'aina Biocultural Conservation Stories from Pacific Island Youth. That's today at 4 p.m. at the Hawaii Convention Center.
Well, that was a fast hour that just flew by.
It was.
Speaking of flying, you are going to fly away for a couple of weeks.
Homeward bound, or at least New England bound for a couple of weeks. Yeah.
Well,
a change
we'll
of weather,
you.
That's for sure.
Well, that's true. Although you don't know what you're going to fly into, it might be something that you just left.
You never know.
We will miss you. But up tomorrow, we will be back here with Katie Miller, the regional coordinator of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. And we're going to talk about some potential problems with monetary policy in the future and long term with the lack of inflation with UHERO's Carl Bonham.
And we'll look at Palikou Theater's newest musical, 1776.
Our talkback line is 808-792-8217.
And you can find past shows under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you in the morning with more of The Conversation.